We're going to talk a little bit about Yahoo today, why that company is proving so hard to fix. A word or two about oil as well, and then living life under a cloud of natural gas. You can smell it, you can't see it. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, the 2nd of February. Good to have you with us, as always, everybody. All right, so honestly, I don't know what to say at this point. Unmoored might be a good word to use to describe the daily ups and downs on Wall Street since New Year's. Disconnected from reality might be good, although there is a glimmer of not-so-great economic reality going on out there. So maybe what we do is we just go with, whew, boy, this is interesting, huh? Of special interest today, you know, apart from all the red ink in equities, was another precipitous drop in the price of crude oil. The U.S. benchmark down another 5.5% today, under $30 a barrel once again. And not coincidentally, BP reported a $3.3 billion fourth quarter loss today. ExxonMobil says its quarterly profits are down by more than half from a year ago. A far cry, I think you would agree, from the days of crude at nearly $150 a barrel back before the recession, when companies were jumping at the chance to get into that market. More production begets more supply, begets lower prices, which we have today. But it's not like anybody ought to be surprised at what's going on. Marketplace's Andy Euler gets us going with another commodity with a similar history.
Unless you work in the oil industry, should you really be concerned about $30 for a barrel of oil?
No. To economists, it's just the right level of prices.
Scott Irwin teaches economics at the University of Illinois.
Commodity markets have always been prone to significant boom and bust cycles.
When prices are high, everyone tries to up production to get some of that money, see fracking or Arctic exploration. And it happens with any commodity. A rise in production leads to a glut and falling prices. Although oil is something we talk about every day, it's not like we can go to the store and pick up a cheap barrel of the stuff now that it's on sale. Unlike, for example...
Hi, this is Richard Waycott. I'm president and CEO of the Almond Board of California.
Waycott says it's been a good couple of years for almond growers in California. They've been able to charge historic high prices.
And that's been primarily because our supply hasn't been growing as it was in previous years.
But this year's crop was bigger than expected. Next year's will probably follow. Because when the price of almonds went up, money followed. Foreign investment and hedge funds came in to plant more trees. And just like dumping a ton of money into drilling a well, you've got to think years ahead when you're planting. David Bessler is an agriculture economics professor at Texas A&M.
The dynamics of prices and quantities are hard to figure out, and farmers generally overreact.
And so now, you guessed it, we're seeing a price correction. Almonds are going for about 25% less than they were over the summer. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
All the various presidential campaigns have left Iowa in the rearview mirror. It's New Hampshire or bust now in a primary a week from today. Ted Cruz won the Republican caucus last night, despite, or maybe because of Donald Trump, I don't know, but certainly despite his opposition to something called the Renewable Fuel Mandate, which in Iowa means a 2007 federal law requiring corn ethanol be blended with gasoline. Iowa grows a whole lot of corn, as you might know, but Cruz has plenty of company in being against the mandate. So, Marketplace's Annie Baxter reminds us where things stand with the powerful ethanol lobby these days.
The renewable fuel standard aimed to reduce Americans' dependence on foreign oil and promote what seemed like a more environmentally friendly fuel source. But it's had some perhaps unintended effects.
The renewable fuel standard is essentially an income redistribution program.
Vince Smith teaches economics at Montana State University and is critical of the standard. He says when farmers grew corn for ethanol instead of food, that pushed up the price of corn. And all sorts of food products became more expensive for American consumers, while a limited number of farmers benefited. Plus, it turns out that corn ethanol production involves significant greenhouse gas emissions.
And it's actually worse for the climate than gasoline.
Emily Cassidy is with the Environmental Working Group.
And it also increases the amount of pollutants that get into water by increasing fertilizer use.
Despite a push from environmentalists and even big oil companies, the Environmental Protection Agency recently declined to lower the biofuels requirements. For his part, Minnesota corn farmer Bruce Schmall hopes to keep the standards in play. All the corn he grows goes to ethanol.
We've put a lot of effort into this industry already, and to just let it dry up in the grave. grapevine, so to speak. I think that's a poor way to go after, you know, all the effort and money that's been put into it.
He'll keep a close eye on how close Ted Cruz gets to the White House, as it might take a presidential push to reduce or eliminate the standards. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
All right, if you don't like mine, go ahead and pick your word to describe Wall Street of late. Roller coaster is one option. Risk-averse trading is another. Volatility is what the professionals like to call all this crazy up and down and down and up. Whatever the word you use, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. We've spent some time the past couple of days on tech companies and their profit reports. Apple and Google by name, how much money they're making, and what the future might hold. Today, we got the numbers for another and a quite a bit more troubled Silicon Valley giant. Yahoo reported after the bell this afternoon. Revenue was down. Profits? Well, there weren't any. Layoffs? There are going to be some of those. And more significant, CEO Marissa Mayer said the company is going to explore, and this is a quote, strategic alternatives, which is widely being interpreted to mean a sale of some or all of itself. So we got Ben Johnson, the host of Marketplace Tech, on the line to talk about why Yahoo has been so hard to fix for low these many years. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Kai.
So this is not the first try that Yahoo has had at, I guess we would say, fixing things, right?
So many swings, so many misses, Kai. They've got the Tumblr acquisition. That hasn't quite paid off, even though Yahoo sort of famously let it do its thing after buying the blogging platform for $1.1 billion. They've tried and failed to make a video service that would compete with Amazon and Netflix. Marissa Mayer announced a while back that the company would refocus on search. Mm-hmm. And we, you wouldn't believe how fast some users stopped using Firefox when that web browser started using Yahoo as its default search engine. These are not bad ideas, Kai, but good ideas sometimes just don't work.
So what are the assets, right? Because it's not like Yahoo has an empty shelf there, right?
Okay, technical term here, boatloads of users, I believe it's called, right. Kai. Yahoo Finance does really well. The company's sports vertical does really well. Yahoo is the third most visited website on planet Earth. That's behind Facebook and Google.com. Yahoo Mail delivers 30 billion email messages a day. Now, a lot of that is spam, of course, but a lot of it is real email. All of this stuff we're talking about is what we're talking about when we see headlines about Yahoo wanting to spin off its internet services or investors wanting it to do that.
Right.
And also Yahoo has just a mere $30 billion or so, a.k.a. its 15% stake in Alibaba, that whole thing.
So riddle me this then. Why has this proven such a tough nut to crack? And because it's not just Marissa Mayer that's trying to do this for Yahoo, right?
This is game time for Yahoo. There's a board re-election this summer. They were thinking about spinning off Alibaba. Investors stopped that. Marissa Mayer has people breathing down her neck. So does the board. And the thing is their tries have been admirable, I think many would say. And it's just tough. Fundamentally, Yahoo has a product problem. And what I mean by that is it just hasn't built stuff that has gained traction yet, Kai. Now, we've been talking about Google this week, the company I like to call Google, which others call Alphabet now.
No, I'm with you, man. I'm with you there.
Alphabet has been able to create this narrative where it's got this huge cash cow in selling advertising through search, but it also has these other ideas for products of the future. And they may not pan out, but it feels like they're doing things that could really pay off. Yahoo hasn't really done that. Yahoo has been all about acquisitions, which is a different thing. And a lot of the stuff it's tried just hasn't worked out. And if it can't figure out how to turn its billions, millions of users into dollar signs, it's going to feel like it's stuck in the past. And that guy is going to get really awkward for its leadership.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you, Kai.
You think power companies in this country have it rough? Think for just a second about the challenge of delivering electricity to 1.3 billion people. That's part of why China has built more than 20,000 dams on rivers all over that country. Hydropower is obviously the word you're looking for here. There is, however, and against all odds, one single remaining free-flowing river in China without any dams on it at all. It's called the Nujiang, and it runs for hundreds of miles along China's mountainous border with Burma. There are, though, plans to build a series of dams along the Nujiang now, affecting millions of people on both sides of that border. So, as part of our series on China's frontier towns, our China correspondent Rob Schmitz goes up the river.
In the mountains along China's border with Burma lives a man named Aloa.
Aloa, that's it. No last name. Tibetans usually go by just one name.
Aloa's tall, stone-faced, and his head is topped with a cowboy hat. He grew up herding sheep here, along a tributary of the New River. But then, one day, a group of rich outsiders arrived to his village, looking to invest.
They were from Fujian, Guangzhou, and there were a few overseas Chinese from Canada and Italy.
They built a dam, sold the electricity, and flooded his village. Aloa sold his sheep and moved away. Aloa now lives along the banks of the Nu, the last remaining river in China without a dam. But there's a plan to build 13 dams along this river. Villages have already been moved to make way. If the dams are built, China's last free-flowing river will turn into a series of cascading lakes.
This river is vital. China must leave our last free-flowing river for future generations.
Wang Yongchen is founder of Beijing-based Green Earth Volunteers.
If we lose the New River, we won't be able to have a single reference for comparison between what is natural and what isn't.
Her organization has fought for a decade to keep the New River the way it is. But in GDP-obsessed China, Wang admits it's been difficult. She recites a popular Chinese saying born from recent years of the country's surging investment-led infrastructure growth. It goes, grass high-rise, silver road, golden bridge, diamond dam. Fan Xiao, a retired government geologist, says thousands of dams are being built on China's rivers, earning diamonds worth of profits for the rich and powerful.
A local government sets up an investment company, attracts investors, approves and builds its own projects with developers. All of them make enormous profits. They claim this helps alleviate poverty, but it only causes common people more problems.
Since the birth of communist China, 24 million people have been forced to relocate for 86,000 dams. What's worse, says Fan, is many of these dams aren't even generating electricity. By his count, 8% of the electricity generated by dams in his home province of Sichuan goes to waste.
We call this water abandonment, and in China, it's severe. Dozens of large-scale dams are losing money.
And this could be the reason why dams on the New River are on hold. Green Earth's Wang Yongchen claims the local government is about to scrap plans to dam the river, but local officials contacted by Marketplace deny this. Downstream in Burma, where the river is called the Salween, it may not matter. Chinese companies plan to build 6 dams on that portion of the river anyway. Upstream in China, the Tibetan man Aloa says years after his village was submerged by a dam built by rich outsiders, he happened to see one of them on a bus ride along the New River.
He kept bragging to everyone that he was an overseas Chinese who had made it rich. He said, "I came back to invest, to help my homeland."
After listening to this guy for half an hour, Aloa couldn't stand it any longer.
I stood up and yelled at him, "If you like China so much, why'd you leave? You only came back here to make money for yourself. How are you helping us?"
The scared investor stepped off the bus, left behind beside the last free-flowing river of his homeland. In the New River Valley along the border of Burma, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Coming up,
I'm not able to open my windows or my doors. There's no such thing as fresh air.
Life under a cloud of methane. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 295 points today, 1.8%, 16,153. The NASDAQ down 103 points, 2.25%, 45.16. The S&P 500 dropped 36 points, 1.8% there as well, ended things at 1903. Low oil hit energy again. Chevron trickled down 4.75%. Duke Energy bowed about a third of 1% lower. Fears that energy loans could go bad hit bank stocks. Wells Fargo off 2.2%. Citigroup down 4.8%. Handbag and accessories maker Michael Kors toted a 24% gain after posting better-than-expected third-quarter results. But LVMH, the world's biggest luxury goods group, lost 1.75% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.85%. Think flight to safety, y'all, all right? You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We are and have been for some time in an era of industrial robots and assembly line automation. Think cars for just the most prominent example. There are, though, a few things still largely built by hand, and among them are large things. I'm talking here about jet engines. I know, who'd have thought? Hand-built, right? But with a rise in demand for commercial airplanes has come a need for jet engine builders to take a fresh look at their very old assembly technique. From WNPR in Connecticut, Harriet Jones reports.
This is Pratt & Whitney's plant in Middletown, Connecticut, where several jet engines in various states of readiness hang suspended from a track on the ceiling. This assembly line represents one part of a multi-billion dollar investment Pratt has made in a new engine and a new way of making it.
We're standing at the beginning of the assembly line, at the beginning of the oval.
I'm being shown around by Tom Mays, who runs this facility.
It moves down one side of the oval like a racetrack, and it has progressive steps of assembly.
Henry Ford may have invented large-scale moving assembly for automobiles in the early 1900s, but in the aerospace industry, this line is completely revolutionary. Engines under construction can glide with the push of a button from one build station to the next. On the other side of the same shop floor, engines are still being built the old way.
In a static build structure, the engine doesn't move or rotate, so you're climbing on ladders to reach the top assemblies, you're crawling on your back to reach bottom assemblies.
With this new line, the mechanic can position the engine precisely, kind of like the preset button on a car seat.
The mechanic, when he's doing an assembly operation, the computer knows where he prefers the rotation and the up and down and can automatically go there at his desire.
It is a lot easier. I'm a big guy, and reaching up and bending over takes its toll on me.
Senior mechanic Neil Werboff has worked for Pratt for 37 years.
It was futuristic. It was something out of Star Wars for me, you know, for a jet engine assembly. We've done things so long the old way that you become entrenched in the way of doing things, and something new like this is like, will it work? Is it a good idea? Should we change? And the first engine we did on this, I never want to go back to the old way.
And that reaction, says Ted Sluice, is exactly the point.
The easier you make the mechanic's job, the better quality product that you get, the more efficient the product is produced, and ultimately the more you can build in a year.
Sluice is one of the engineers who designed this system. He says the reason jet engines have never been built like cars is because they've always been a low-volume business.
If you didn't have the volume on this product line, you would never do this. The investment has to buy itself in, and that efficiency gain has to have a payback over a certain period of time. And without the volume, it doesn't do that.
The engine that's being built this way is the key to the volume. It's a new technology that Pratt calls Pure Power, designed to burn 15% less fuel than a conventional engine. The company now has a backlog of orders for about 7,000 of these engines. With the old method of assembly, it could have built about 300 a year in this engine center. Now, with moving assembly lines installed here and at its facility in West Palm Beach in Florida, it could potentially build 1,000 a year.
The real challenge in any new technology is, of course, learning how to build it and learning how to build it at a profit.
Aerospace analyst Richard Abulafia of the Thiel Group says it won't always be a smooth road ahead for Pratt.
Driving down costs, driving down defects when they happen in the manufacturing process, and, of course, just the investment needed to ramp up to levels that Pratt hasn't seen in the commercial business in decades.
Some of those speed bumps were evident in December when Airbus, the biggest customer for the new engine, had to delay delivery of the first of its A320neo jets, in part because of technical issues with the engine. But that was rectified just recently as Lufthansa became the first airline to put the new engine into service. In Middletown, I'm Harriet Jones for Marketplace.
Back this past October, people in the town of Porter Ranch, about 30 miles or so from downtown Los Angeles, started smelling gas.
Like a stinky, makes you have an instant headache, want to puke smell. Some people refer to it like a skunk.
It was a methane leak from a storage well in the mountains just behind town. Since then, 3 months ago, the utility, Southern California Gas, has tried unsuccessfully to close a leak that's putting 1,200 tons of methane into the air every single day. All by itself, that's enough to raise the entire state's greenhouse gas emissions 25%. Porter Ranch is a tiny little bedroom community up in the San Fernando Valley. Homes run the whole range, apartment buildings to 2- and 3-bedroom ranch houses to high-end gated communities. There are a couple of strip malls in between. We pulled into one that had a Whole Foods and a couple of restaurants, a dry cleaner, and at one end, a salon called Le Salon Complet, where Tammy Fiola was on her way to work. She's lived in Porter Ranch
10 years, and nothing's like this ever happened.
Tell me about your daily life, knowing that this is sort of in the air, literally in the air.
Well, I'm not able to open my windows or my doors. There's no such thing as fresh air. And I have to come to work every day, and our door opens and closes 100 times a day, you know, and the air is still going into the salon, and we're breathing it. So it's just, you just have to think twice, you know. You can't go out for a walk. You can't go, you know, on the weekends we try and go to another area so we can exercise or go on walks, because I don't want to be breathing this more than I have to.
Tell me about whatever symptoms you might have been having.
I've had dizziness. I've had, I got so bad right after Thanksgiving. I was putting my Christmas decorations out in front, and I was so dizzy and disorientated that I thought I was having a stroke. But at that point in my life, I didn't have medical insurance, so I didn't want to go to the doctor because I really don't have the funds to do that.
You do now, though? You have
I do
insurance
now, yeah. So I do have an appointment to, I'm supposed to go to the doctor next week. So we'll see if any of what I'm having has to do with this lovely gas that I've been breathing for the last few months.
But you're still here.
I know I'm still here. I work here. So, I mean, it's not going to really, what good is it going to do me to relocate when I'm here 9-10 hours a day? How much difference is it going to be if I sleep someplace else?
I asked her where she got her information from SoCal Gas about what's going on.
Up in the Walmart shopping center, not far from here, they have a center you can go to. It's usually a 2-hour wait, though, to talk to someone there.
So I went looking for it. It's officially called the SoCal Gas Community Resource Center.
So this is the office she was talking about, right up here by Walmart, right? This is the center? Yeah.
It's another pretty standard strip mall. There's a mattress store and a nail salon, Walmart and Best Buy down at the other end. And at this point, by the way, I'm pretty convinced that I can smell the gas.
No, you can totally smell it. I don't know, maybe not. Maybe I'm just paranoid.
It was about 9:30 in the morning. There are already 2 dozen people in line. The place doesn't open until 10. Carl Newton was there. He was looking for information about relocating. He would move, he says.
Oh, yeah, yeah. My eyes are swollen. So whether it's that, I don't think it's allergies. I have allergies. I know what brings that on and what happens to me. This is something new, so.
How did you know that there was a leak going on? Did you experience it first, or did you hear about it on the news?
I smelled it. Very strong. I thought there was a gas leak in the neighborhood. That's how strong it was. Then I guess it was a month later we found out it was up here. Remember when they had the oil leak in Gulf of Mexico?
Yeah.
And every day they would show you the oil pumping into the Gulf? That's what they should do here. You can't see this. That's the problem. If you could see that stuff going up 24/7, maybe everybody else, maybe there'd be more people calling Southern California Gas and telling them to do more, work faster, work harder. It's in the air. We're all breathing it. As we stand here, we're all breathing it. But where's the outrage? It's just here in Porter Ranch.
Mike Mizrahi is a spokesman for Southern California Gas. We got him on the phone.
It's very frustrating for SoCal Gas to have something like this, to have customers look at us, you know, with a lack of trust.
The company's best guess for when the leak is going to be plugged?
Well, we are saying officially the end of February or sooner.
You can smell the leak, but you can't see it unless you've got an infrared camera. We've got an infrared video on our website. It's marketplace.org. Check it out. Just final note on the way out today, a quick word about money and politics. Millions of dollars, of course, were spent in Iowa the past year or so to get votes last night. Some candidates were better at it than others. The Huffington Post did the math. Jeb Bush, he and his super PAC spent about $14 million in the Hawkeye State. He got 5,000 votes. Sixth place, spent about $2,800 per vote. GOP winner Ted Cruz, about $250 per. Return on investment, people, that's the word you're looking for here. Return on investment. The Dow off 295 points today, 1.8%. The NASDAQ down 103 points, 2.25%. The S&P 500 off 36 points, 1.8%. Remember what I said, volatility. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner. The senior digital producer is Nishat Kurwa. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.